Good morning, everyone, and thank you so much for joining us for SPIRIT, the Stimulating Program Initiative for Retirees that Inspires Thought. I'm Judy Steinig, Director of Community Programs for the Orthodox Union, and it's my honor to coordinate and host this program. SPIRIT was started several years ago as an on-site program, and now we're happy to produce it as an online program for baby boomers, empty nesters, retirees, not yet retirees, sandwich generation parents, and seniors, everybody who still continues to shelter in because of the pandemic. SPIRIT has become the perfect way for all of us to engage in a virtual setting as we look for opportunities for educational, intellectual, and spiritual growth. Today, we are happy to welcome Eli Gnauer to the SPIRIT Forum. Eli lives in Seattle, Washington, and he's a collector of antique svarim, which are Jewish books. He has written and lectured extensively about his collection and has had a long association with the Orthodox Union, having served as national vice president for many years. Today's topic will be how old svarim come alive. It is my honor to turn the SPIRIT Forum over to Eli Gnauer. Thank you for joining us.
Hi there. Thank you very much for the introduction. Rabbi Vera Wein always says, I'm very anxious to hear what I'm going to say. So I think what I would like to do is start out today with a story. Rebbetzin Steinig said, I collect old books. And this is a story that spans all four hemispheres, Western Hemisphere and Eastern Hemisphere and Northern and Southern Hemisphere. So I'll start out by showing you a book. And it's, as you can see, I'm not sure whether you can see it or not, but it's a Sefer HaLevush. And it was printed in Prague in 1701. And not the first edition. Sefer HaLevush is a book of halacha written by Rabbi Mordechai Yaffe. This one that was printed in 1701 in Prague was the first one that had the commentary of Eliyahu Zutta. And the story behind this book is that actually the book that I'm going to talk about is not the one that I was holding in my hands, because the one that I'm going to talk about I don't have anymore. And the story goes like this. A few years ago, I davened in a small shul in a suburb of Seattle, an OU shul, by the name of Shevet Achim or Island Synagogue. During the Shalosh Shudas, the third meal on Shabbat, many times I talk about my old books. So I have a friend who works for Microsoft, and he's a software engineer, and he travels the world. And he's very, very fascinated with my old books. And one time he found himself in Warsaw, Poland. This is a few years ago. And he thought, well, maybe in Warsaw, he'll go to an antiquarian bookstore and see if he can find any old Hebrew books. So he walked into a store and he asked them, do you have any old Jewish books, any old Hebrew books? And the owner who was standing there said, no. We don't have. But it turns out that there was a woman who had been working there for many years, and she said, yeah, I think we have one down in the basement. So she went down to the basement, and about 20 minutes later, she came back up with the one Hebrew book that they had, which was this Sefer HaLevush, printed in 1701. So my friend bought it, and he brought it back to me as a gift. I had it, and I started looking at it, and it was wonderful. You know, it's a book that's 300 years old. And I'm always interested in you know, who owned the book before it somehow got to Seattle. And as I looked around in the book, there was a stamp. And let's see, this is what the stamp looked like. So I'll read it for you. It says as follows. It says, Shmuel David Yakubovich, Lublin, Shiroka 16. Shmuel David Jacobowitz, Lublin, Shiroka 16, number 657. So what you see from here is the idea that it was owned by a man who lived in Lublin, and you could tell that he was a collector. And the reason why you can tell he was a collector is because he had a stamp. And this book was number 657. So we knew we had at least 657 books. So I was curious about it. It's rather modern in the sense that it's not an old signature, it's a stamp. On the other hand, the Jewish population from Lublin was eradicated completely by the end of 1942. So it wasn't post-1942, it had to be before that. So that got me to thinking that it possibly this belonged to somebody who was killed in the Holocaust. And as it turned out, it was actually pretty easy to track. So what I did was I went on Yad Vashem. And of course, anyone who knows Yad Vashem knows that that is the martyr and hero's remembrance authority of Israel. And they have a database of all the people who were killed, as many as they possibly can, I think 4.5 million at this point in time, all the people that were murdered in the Holocaust. And their idea, of course, is instead of to say 6 million, you have actually 6 million individuals, and every person that they can possibly track, they have a page of testimony. So it's very easy to find this particular individual, Shmuel David Jacobowitz. And one of the reasons from Lublin, and one of the reasons because it actually had his address. So I'll show you what the page of testimony looks like. Just so you get an idea. So that's what it looks like. And these pages of testimony are usually filled out by relatives who survived. And this one was filled out, the testimony was given by his daughter, Mincha Jacobowitz. And as I said, the reason why I knew I had the right person is because it says here, permanent residence, place and country. And it says here, Shiroka 16, Lublin, Polonia. So I knew that the book that I had, that my friend brought me back from an old bookstore in Warsaw, had belonged to a man who, according to his daughter, Mincha Jacobowitz, was killed in 1942 in Majdanek. So that got me to thinking, maybe it would be interesting to find this daughter who actually signed this page of testimony in 1999, many, many years after the war. And it said here that she lived in São Paulo, Brazil. So now I had her name and I had the fact that she lived in São Paulo, Brazil. So I put that all into the computer. And unfortunately, as you might imagine, a survivor of the Holocaust, she had passed away in the year 2005. But, you know, as they say, everything is on the internet right now. And there was actually burial information on her. She's buried in Cementerio Israelita Dobutayanta. And it even has exactly where the grave site. So I figured I'll contact the cemetery and see if they have any relatives, because usually they send out a yard site notice, something like that. I didn't hear back from them. I tried using Google Translate to send to them in Portuguese, and nothing. So then I figured, oh, you know what I'll do? I'll contact Chabad. If there's anyone Jewish, if there was anyone Jewish, Chabad will know. And I contacted them. They were very nice, but they said they had never heard of this woman and they didn't know she had any relatives. So I reached a dead end there. But then I had another idea. There's a woman who's worked for me for the last 35 years or so. And I know that she has a brother who lives down in Brazil, who's retired. He's a retired university professor from Tacoma, Washington. And he now lives in Brazil. He married a woman from Brazil and he moved down there. And he's retired and he's a university professor. So I figured maybe he'd be interested in following up on this. His name is Alan French. And what Alan did was he made an appointment to go to the cemetery because they were open from 9 to 12 every day. And he went there and he explained what was going on. I had contacted him and I had sent him all the information that I had. And so they said to him, you know, this Mincha Jacobowitz does have a son who lives here in Sao Paulo, but we're not going to give you the name and number. We'll contact him. We'll give him your phone number and they'll see if he's interested. And sure enough, a few days later, Alan gets a call from someone by the name of Samuel Jacobowitz. Now, if you remember, the Holocaust martyr was named Shmuel Jacobowitz. And this is Dr. Samuel Jacobowitz. He's a grandson of Shmuel Jacobowitz. And so Alan arranged, I sent the book down to Alan down in Brazil. It took a couple of weeks for it to get there, but it got there eventually. And I want to show you a picture of Alan met with Samuel Jacobowitz for coffee. You could see they were in a coffee shop. This is pre-COVID. And I'll just show you a picture and you could see Alan is the person with the beard and Samuel is the one holding the book. And the woman is Samuel's wife, Miriam. So here we go. So I'm going to try and get this a little bit closer. So you can see they're meeting for coffee there. And it's Alan with the beard from Tacoma, Washington. And he's meeting with Dr. Samuel Jacobowitz, who's holding the book. And that's Miriam Jacobowitz, Samuel's wife. And you know, when I looked at this picture of Samuel, I see the face of Polish Jewry. That's what I see. And so, as I say, he's the grandson of Shmuel Jacobowitz, who was murdered in the Holocaust in 1942 in Majdanek. And as I said, this book really has had quite a story behind it because it started out in Prague in 1701. At some point in time, it ended up in Lublin and then 50 years later, 75 years later, it ended up in a bookstore in Warsaw. After that, it ended up on Mercer Island, Washington, that's a suburb of Seattle, and now it's in Sao Paulo, Brazil. So as I said, the book started out in the Eastern Hemisphere, got to the Western Hemisphere, it was in the Northern Hemisphere when it started out, and now it's in the Southern Hemisphere. And Samuel was very, very appreciative that I found him, and he said that the book will be treasured for many, many years by his family for generations to come. Matter of fact, he even has a granddaughter that's extremely interested in the history of the family. So this is something wonderful that you can do with an old book. Let me go on to another book. Let's see what I have here. Let's see. Ah, here we go. So this book here, you know, I always say books come in all shapes, and this is a very small book. And it's called, what's it called? It's called Kol Yaakov. And this is the way it looks. Let's see if I can get it to be open. Kol Yaakov. So it was printed in Amsterdam in 1707. And it's actually the second edition, the first edition of this particular book. Small book, only has 25 pages. The first edition was printed in Venice in 1658. So why did I buy this book? Well, the reason is because the author was a man by the name of Yaakov Koppel Ben Zvi Margolius. And my father, I'll show him, his name was Yaakov Koppel. So I'm very, very interested in anything written by Yaakov Koppel. And actually, I have a grandson named Yaakov Koppel, and I have even now a great-grandson named Yaakov Koppel. So a book like this gives me an opportunity to learn about things that I didn't know about before. And one of the reasons why I like collecting or buying old books is because I get to combine two passions that I have. One is learning Torah, and the other one is history, especially Jewish history. So it turns out that Yaakov Koppel Ben Zvi Margolius lived in Ukraine, and he lived there in the 1600s, and he himself was an eyewitness to the Cossack uprising there that killed so many Jewish people. It's called Gzeiras Tachvatat, the decrees of 1648 and 1649. Where many Jews were killed both in Ukraine and in Poland, the terrible tragedy. And he apparently escaped to Germany and was able to write about it. But besides that, he gave drushes. So one particular drusha that he gave, which is written in this book, has to do with the tefillah, the prayer of mincha that we say every day. One of his points is as follows. When it comes to shacharis, that's named after shachar. That's the morning. And ma'ariv, or arvit, arvis, is named after erev, which is the evening. But mincha is not named after a time of day. And he said, really, it should be called Tzoharayim. So why is it called Mincha? So he says, because Mincha, actually, the whole idea that Yitzchak Avinu was involved with the Akedah, with the binding of Isaac, is as a kapara, as an atonement for a sin that the Jewish people hadn't even committed yet, which is the sin of the ego, of the golden calf. And Yitzchak, Avram and Yitzchak's idea was that when Hashem sees a Mizbeach, when Hashem sees an altar, instead of him seeing the altar that the Jewish people danced around during the sin of the golden calf, rather Hashem should see the altar, the Mizbeach, on which Yitzchak was bound. And so in a sense, Mincha is a replacement for ego, for the chet ha-ego, for the sin of the golden calf. And something that I never realized, which he points out, is that the gematria for mincha is exactly the same as ego. So as we say in Hebrew, zeh tamurat zeh, this is in place of this. Now that's a Dvar Torah from this particular book. But I'd like to show you at the end, he wrote a kina, an elegy, on what he calls Zehakina, this is an elegy, Sigarti, al Haruge Chachme Polonia, Hashem Yikom Damam. This is an elegy that I've written on the elders and the wise people of Poland who were killed. God should avenge their blood. I'll just give you an idea what it looks like. So you can imagine this is written originally. Let's see if we can get that in there. Yeah. This was written originally in, well, was printed originally in 1658. You may have written it a few years before, right after the terrible events of 1648 and 1649. And one of the things that's interesting about this particular elegy, which I've seen in other elegies for the Holocaust and other tragedies of the Jewish people, is they speak about not only the loss of life, but the loss of Torah knowledge. And he repeatedly stresses that in this particular elegy, that Chachamim and Dayanim and Talmidei Chachamim were all killed. And the Torah that they knew is irreplaceable. Now, that's one thing that's here. On a more positive note, he has here something very interesting. I'll show you again. Let's see if we can get it up here. You can see that there's Yedid Nefesh. And it says as follows. It says, well, it's first it says Kol Yaakov. It says Shir Zeh LaOmer Achar HaLimud. It's nice to say a poem like this after you learn. And it has the poem Yedid Nefesh, which we usually sing either on Friday night before Kabbalah Shabbos, before welcoming the Sabbath, or usually in the third meal and Shalosh, what we call Shalosh Shudas, or here in Seattle, we have a big Sephardic community. They call it Seudah Shlishit. So I'm kind of used to both. But this says that this is something that should be said after learning. So I'd never seen something like that before. And if you're familiar at all with Yedid Nefesh, you know that there's a couple of different versions of it. There's a, I always say a machlokas between, there's a dispute between Art Scroll and Koren. Art Scroll has, you know, what I would call the standard one, and the new Koren Siddurim have one based on older manuscripts. And this one here, instead of having Ela Chamda Libi, as we have in our text, has Ona Eli Simchas Libi, Hushana. So a different text even than the one that the Koran has. Let's see. Ah. So I want to show you something now that I became very involved with over the last 10 years or so, and it's actually easy to see why. I started collecting, or I started buying, old Gemaras. And I bought one from that was printed in Amsterdam in 1646, which I'll show you in a minute. But I want to show you what caught my eye. So this is, we're learning Gemara Erevin now in Daf Yomi. And this is one of the more recent pages. It's 55A, Nun Hei Amar Aleph. I'll hold it up for you. And this is a small Gemara. I figured this would be easy to show in the computer. So you can see it has a number of diagrams in Rashi. And what it is Rashi himself made in his commentary. Many times he would write a description, and then he would use the word kozer, like this, and he would draw a diagram. We have that quite a bit. So let's see. I get a lot of exercise with some of these old books. This one is, let's see, you can see this book. Not only is the book 375 years old, but I think the cover is also. And what is it? The way they had the old covers was they had wood and they overlaid it with leather. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to turn to that particular page, and you'll see what it looks like in this Gemara that was printed in 1646. And see if you can see whether anything is missing. Let's see. We can get that up there. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that shows pretty good. So as you see, instead of diagrams, there's empty spaces. And when I started to look at these, I said to myself, what happened to the diagrams? It turns out that, as I mentioned to you, Rashi himself had diagrams in his commentary, and we have many manuscripts of Rashi. Even today, there's a website called Kativ, National Library of Israel, and there's actually 7 really good manuscripts of Rashi and Erevin, and they all have these diagrams. But what happened was, when printing started, and the first set of the first printed completed set of Talmud Bavli, the Babylonian Talmud, was printed in around the year 1520. Either they didn't have the technology, or more, it's possible that it just cost a lot to reproduce the diagrams. So they took the words of Rashi. And for example, Rashi would be talking and he would say, you know, explain something, and then he would say kozeh, and then all you would see was a blank space because they didn't reproduce the diagram. And that happened, that went on for about 200 years, from 1520 to 1697. All people saw, if they bought a Gemara, that was printed in 1520 or 1528 or 1538 or 1546, 1580, 1644, all they saw were blank spaces. So that got me on a path to try and figure out, you know, if the diagrams that we have today, let's say in the Vilna Shas, are the ones that actually were in Rashi. Kind of spent about the last 10 years working on that. And that all came about because of this old book that I had. And I'll conclude now with one of the older books I have. You know, I always say that you can never tell a book by its cover. So for example, I showed you a book before with a really old cover that was from 1646. This one has a brand new cover and it's from 1546. So what is it? It's a very lovely, really, really nice book. I had heard of it, but I never knew much about it. I have to tell you a story about my granddaughter. So my granddaughter was younger. She said to me once, she said, Zeta. You know, it's only grandchildren that do Zeta. She says, I don't understand. You buy books and then you put them on a shelf. And what do? You just look at them for a few minutes and then you put them away. She said, books are for learning. So I said, you know what? You're right. So from then on, which was about 10 years ago, I never buy a book unless I'm going to go through it. So here was one that I bought because it's a beautiful book, but I've really gone through it. And it's just, as I say, a lovely book. So it's called Sefer Kat HaKemach by Rabbeinu. There are two Rabbeinu Bachyas. This one is Rabbeinu Bachya ben Asher. And I want to show you on the bottom something that I think is really interesting. You see, there's a picture of, let's see, it'll come out. Yeah, it's not too bad. I'm looking at a small screen here, so it's a little bit hard to see. But there's a picture of the Beis HaMikdash, or what looks like it might be the Beis HaMikdash. And there's some words on it, and I'll read it for you. It was printed by the Giustiani Printing Company. And it says, Godol yiyeh kvod habayis hazeh amar Hashem tzvakos. So this is a play on words on a pasuk in Haggai. I looked it up this morning. Second parak, ninth pasuk. That speaks about the fact that the second Beis HaMikdash will be greater than the first Beis HaMikdash. And all the Mephoshim say it's because it lasted 420 years versus 410 years. So what is this doing? As this is called the printer's mark here. I'll show it to you again. What's it doing here on a book? So the idea is that the original, the main printer in Venice was Daniel Bomberg. And Daniel Bomberg was the one that printed the first, what they call the first rabbinic Bible, the Mikraos HaGadolos, what's called the Mikraos HaGadolos, the first one to print a full set of Talmud Bavli, Babylonian Talmud, the Jerusalem Talmud. And for 25 or 30 years, he was the king of printers in Venice. And this Giustiani started up in the 1540s, and they felt that they were going to take over from Bamberg. So as their printer's mark, they had a picture of the Beis HaMikdash just saying that the second house, meaning the house of Giustiani, would be greater than the first house, that of Bomberg. So every once in a while, you get these interesting things that have to do with printers. Let's see if I have time for one more. A picture. This is very interesting. This is a machzor. I was just using this on Sukkos, and you can see. Let's see if we got, I'll do the English side. So this was printed in London in 1824. And turns out I didn't pay that much for it. And the reason why, I mean, it's a very nice machzor. It's a third edition of a set of machzorim that were printed, started back in the 1780s. And the translator was David Levy. And it, as I say, a very nice machzor. It has English in it. It has a a blessing for George IV, who was the king at the time. But it's missing something. I'll show you what it's missing, how I'm going to do that. I'll explain to you. The machzor that I brought was missing this picture. So what did I do? I got it off the internet and I pasted it in. I should have had one of my grandchildren help me with this. But this is actually a picture of the revisor. Who was the revisor? He was the chief rabbi of England at the time, or chief rabbi of the Polish and German Jews. And his name was, I could read it to you. So the picture says, Tmunas Adonenu Moreno Rabbeinu Achacham Akolol Hagon Agorol Moreno of Shlomo Ben Agon Tzvi. And it says the Reverend Solomon Herschel. So he was the chief rabbi of the German and Polish Jews in England. And I made a little note here that he was the revisor and he was the brother of Saul Berlin. So if anyone is familiar with the controversy about the Summon Rosh, he was the brother of Saul Berlin, who was the one who published or brought out the Besamim Rosh. But this is the way a English rabbi looked in 1824. I just want to point out one thing right at the very beginning. What he did as the reviser. So David Levy had as follows. We say it on Friday nights and we say it Shabbos morning and Mizmor Shir Leoma Shabbos. We say the Pasuk Vatorem Kiraim Karni, which is usually translated as Hashem has lifted up the horns, my horns, like that of a Re'aim. And the Re'aim is usually not translated because we don't know what it is. It was an animal. We don't know, just like a lot of the animals are, you know, in the Torah, if you look in the translation, you'll see just the word transliterated into English. So, but David Levy, who was originally translated, he decided he'd take a shot at it. He wrote like this: "My horn thou makest to rise like that of a unicorn." So he decided that the Re'aim was a unicorn. And Solomon Herschel, who's the reviser, on the bottom, he writes, "This should more I wish I could do a good English accent. This should more properly have been left by the original word Re'aim." So the reviser is saying probably better just to leave it left alone. Anyways, you've been a wonderful audience. A pleasure. I'd like to say something at least about the OU. If you're in my age cohort, you'll know that probably the first time I met the OU was on a can of Heinz vegetarian baked beans. And since that time, the OU has been a wonderful part of my life. And I appreciate the opportunity to speak to you under their auspices, and have a wonderful day.
Eli, thank you so much for that wonderful presentation. I think you, in sharing your library with us and the history of your books, I think you've given all of us a lot to think about. I'm sure many of us have some old antiques farm among our collections. Perhaps we inherited it, and it's a lot that we could think about to find out what those histories are and how, where they are in our family. So I thank you so much, and also for your little commercial about the OU. Very much appreciated. You've always been a beloved member, and we just thank you so much for taking time out to speak with us today. I want to remind everybody that you will be hearing from us, of course, in another day or so, with registrations for other upcoming programs. We are programmed now. I think I have everything scheduled probably into early December. So we have a lot of exciting programs coming up. Of course, you know, Tuesdays and Thursdays, some pre-recorded like this one has been, others that will be live. So stay tuned. And of course, whenever you have spare time, visit our archives, because you will get all of the programs that we've had in the past. We are just about up to date with all of the programming, and we're always happy to have people visit the archives. Everyone, have a wonderful day, be healthy, be safe, and we look forward to seeing you in our next Spirit program. Thank you again, Eli, for spending your time with us. Take care. Everybody have a wonderful day.